You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 107. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about a brighter future from a dark past. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples Treaty Lands, the Dene Nautah, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Dr. Peggy Bernache on the show. Dr. Bernache is a senior lecturer in public history and archaeology at the University of Glasgow and serves as the founding director of the Beniba Centre for Slavery Studies, Scotland's first for supporting and sharing research on slavery, legacies, and leading international and national reparative justice initiatives. As a historical archaeologist, she has excavated sites in West Africa, the Caribbean, and the United States. Many of her public-facing projects include designing massive open online courses and working with national and international theaters, exhibition, and music, science, and culture festivals. In 2025, her portrait was painted as part of an exhibition honoring 100 Black women whose work has made a significant difference in the UK by Serendipity Institute for Black Arts and Heritage. Her international media appearances included the Discovery Science Channel, BBC TV, ITV, and documentaries in the US and Germany. So welcome to the show, Dr. Bernache.
Thank you so much, Jessica. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I'm very interested to hear about your whole journey and how you're doing your work today. It sounds really fascinating. I definitely was getting excited as I was looking through stuff today, especially knowing that there was a food element to all of this. So I'm sure we'll get to that later. But first, what got you interested in this type of work?
Well, actually, I didn't realize that my interest in storytelling would bring me down the path towards anthropology and archaeology. Because originally, I wanted to be a screenwriter.
And oh, cool.
Yeah, wanted to be a screenwriter. But for a number of reasons, that didn't happen. And then I had to do a reset. And I've always had a strong science background. And the more I got into anthropology, I really started just moving towards archaeology. And the idea of being outside, it just felt so cool. And, you know, everyone knows it's just archaeology is just a radically different place. Well, you know, archaeologists, paleontologists, geologists. It's a really different place in, I suppose, the career path that most people are used to, right? It's, you're not in the office and working that 9 to 5 in the same way. But as I started delving into the different kinds of archaeologies that are out there, I started thinking, I'd like to do the archaeology of where my people are from. And so when I decided, I'll tell you why I'm laughing. When I realized that I wanted to look into doing archaeology of the African diaspora, I was at the time still doing CRM work in the North, Mid-Atlantic Northeast. And one of my white colleagues said, wait, you can't do that. And I was just a little baffled, a little confused. What do you mean I can't go to study archaeology of the African diaspora? And she said, well, that's racist.
What?
Yeah. And it totally floored me. And I, again, how does me as a Black person wanting to study the African diaspora make me racist?
And yeah, what did she say?
And she said, well, I'm of Irish heritage. You know, I shouldn't go and try to dig in Ireland. And immediately that's when it really hit me. Oh, not only is she batshit crazy to mm-hmm. say such a thing? And I, as for those who know me, know I don't necessarily have a timid side. So it was quite obvious that with the shovel in my hand and as I started walking towards her, I pretty much said, you could do whatever damn well you want and I will do the same. So, you know, I was encouraged to go cool off. But that was one of the first times it really hit me how much archaeology is part of the imperial project. And I use that example in my classes to explain to who are predominantly white students just how much racism, colonialism, and of course, imperialism really impacts, influences still archaeology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. That's a take.
Yeah. But it's, if anything, it empowered me to move forward and do that kind of work. Because even at the time I was doing CRM in the 90s, I never saw anyone that looked like me. Never saw anyone look like me. There were so few Black archaeologists then, and there are more now. But, you know, by the time I got my PhD, there were still just a handful of us at the time. So much so that, you know, some of my Black colleagues decided to create the Society for Black Archaeologists because they have felt so alienated and without support trying to do the work that we want to do without having to hear stupid remarks like, that makes you racist.
Yeah. I'm curious. What kind of work were you guys doing? You said you were doing historical archaeology in CRM. I mean, were you mostly looking at, you know, white historical archaeology, Black historical archaeology, a mix? Like, I'm just kind of trying to understand like the context for her comment a little bit. Like,
no, when we were doing CRM is whatever the job is where they send you. So of course I was doing prehistoric work. I did contact work. I was doing industrial archaeology. So we were excavating sites all over the mid-Atlantic to Northeast region of the United States that covered everything from, you know, 5,000, whatever, you know, 3,000 years ago to 50 years ago.
Okay. So like, it wasn't something that was already to some extent being studied. It was just the idea of like you only focusing on that, that she had an issue with?
Yes. Yes. Huh. And okay. So that's why I use that as an example to any class I teach on archaeology, that is the first thing I start with, which is, all right, students, buckle in, because the first thing we are going to discuss is how archaeology is part of the imperial project. And I immediately get a number of eye rolls, which, of course, I expect, because the vast majority of those students are white and have always lived a privileged life. So I say, you know what? I will take it back. I will take that statement back if you can answer these questions in these ways. So I say, as American and particularly British archaeologists, we dig everywhere, all over the globe, right? And they all nod their head. I'm like, right. We even go into war-torn, dangerous zones, do we not? And they go, yeah. And I say, okay, right now we are in Scotland. We are in Britain. Do you think, and if you answer me honestly, then I will take this back. Do you think that a group of Nigerian archaeologists would be allowed to dig up Stonehenge?
Right.
And the room falls silent. I say, okay, do you think a group of Chinese archaeologists are allowed to walk into Washington, D.C. and excavate that space and tell Americans about their past? Yeah. Would that be allowed? And they just look at me and I said, you already know the answer. And that is why it is part of the imperial project, that we can go anywhere, but they cannot. The global majority cannot do the same.
That's a really good way of like making that very starkly clear.
Right. And they knew it. They could not say, no, that's not true. They knew it. Mm-hmm. And that's why they kept quiet. And after that, then they were ready to accept the rest of what I was going to be teaching.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, like, you're certainly not the first person on this podcast to have had an experience like that. There's been many people who've had an experience like that. When they said, this is what I want to study, people say, oh, you can't do that. Although this one was interesting because it was slightly different, the whole, like, racist take.
Well, that was just one. That was just one of others. I mean, in fact, the first paying, you know, first CRM job I ever did, I won't go into the area because then it would
make it obvious.
Quickly figure out who it was because there aren't that many firms there.
Yeah,
even now. But the boss, the owner of the CRM firm, he specifically came up to me and he said, "Look, you need to know. I'll be watching you. I know how you people are." So he specifically said that. I know how you people are. So I couldn't stop. I couldn't deny you a job, but I know how you people are. So I'll be watching you.
Dang. Okay.
Yeah.
No, and I mean, I guess, obviously, first of all, you really scared this woman for whatever reason. I don't know why.
She knew I was ready to physically take it there.
Oh, no, I mean, I don't even mean with that. I mean, like, with you saying, I want to study African diaspora, for her response to be, that's racist, like, you really, like, just the idea of you doing that really scared her, obviously.
Oh, you know what? That's interesting. I don't see that as her being scared. I see that as a very typical response of her feeling and in her heart of hearts believing she has the right to police who has the right to do the kind of archaeology that they want to do.
Yeah.
And that is still what we do now. We are still policing. We know that there is no way a bunch of indigenous archaeologists from the South Pacific would be allowed to excavate Longwood Gardens or any of the treasured founding fathers' homes of the South in the Mid-Atlantic region. There, can you imagine Thomas Jefferson's home being excavated by non-Americans?
I mean, oh God.
Yeah. It would never happen.
Never. And it would be that's so what we cruel do and brutal.
We police. Exactly. Yeah. We police.
Yeah. Okay. So obviously though, you knew that this is what you wanted to do. And despite all these people that were making it hard for you and making it clear that you were not welcome, you knew that this is what you wanted to do. So how did you go about doing that? What was your next steps?
Thankfully, I always had and still have supporters. I've always had mentors, archaeologists who either were my professors or adjacent to me because we worked at the museum together or something like that, that fully supported my desire to be part or to excavate the African diaspora. I suppose, so, you know, did my undergrad at University of Florida, fully supported by Kathleen Deegan, when I decided after, so it was, I did my undergrad time there, had a great time, fell in love with archaeology because of Kathleen Deegan, and then decided to do CRM work for a while, just kind of wanted to live a wilder, free life, but then knew I hit a ceiling and needed to go and get my master's and PhD if I wanted to go further, particularly if I wanted to focus on the African diaspora, more so in the Caribbean.
Okay.
So it was later when I, you know, I did my master's and excavated sites in West Africa associated with the slave trade, which I think most people will tell you as an anthropologist or, you know, us as archaeologists still under anthropology, the amount of education and understanding that comes with the work that you're doing is so much deeper than that research question. So much deeper. And often politics comes into play, whether it's the local politics of how are you managing to do that project, within that particular political landscape, or even politics of how you work with others on that project and if they support you or not. So I found out that probably the biggest lesson I learned as I was doing my studies, my graduate studies, was that just because you are a white person doing or excavating sites of the African diaspora doesn't mean you aren't a racist. That was probably the hardest lesson I had to learn, that, there were some issues that did arise where, oh, they feel threatened by me. When you said that woman who said I shouldn't do African diasporic archaeology, that she was scared, I didn't think she was scared, but I definitely know others that I worked with later on were certainly scared, or at least probably better to say threatened by my presence, that the space that had always been controlled by whites could now be by those who don't look like them. That was probably the biggest lesson, and how they will do whatever they need to do to intimidate you or worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not even just control, but I think it confronts them with like the impact of their work, or like the, how to put this exactly, having you there makes them have to think about their work in a different way that they don't want to have to look at because it's certainly uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. But also the kinds of questions and focus that I wanted to do was quite different than theirs.
Right.
And what I also found that was troubling for them was the response that I would get from local Black communities about what it was I wanted to learn was quite different than what some of my white counterparts were interested in. And it made them uncomfortable that I was being so well received by communities. Yeah.
Yeah. Shockingly. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, my guess is, I mean, had they really tried to be well received by the Black community?
You don't have to as a white archaeologist.
Right. That was my thought.
We don't have to be, right?
Right.
We traditionally still, as archaeologists, will get, independent funding, certainly permission from the national or local government to go into an area and excavate. We may use the physical labor of the local community, even though we're trying to understand about that descendant community, that contemporary community's past. But we literally, and I am consciously using this term, we will rape their material culture, that landscape, and take everything away in boxes and share nothing back with them.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
That's still quite common. That is still very common.
Yeah.
So while our students may gain the benefit of understanding about the rise and evolution of certain cultures halfway around the world, the descendant communities of that particular society under study does not get to reap the benefits. Because for the most part, the dissemination of our knowledge of what we've come to understand, of our analysis and our interpretation, are in journals, in peer-reviewed journals, which the general public does not read. And I'm talking the general public of the United States and Britain, much less when you're in the global South.
Okay. Well, wow, I hate to take a break here because we're on a roll, but it is time for our first break. And when we come back, I have so many more questions to ask you. So we will be right back here in a second. All right. So just diving right back in here. One thing that I was thinking about when you were talking earlier, you were saying you wanted to study the African diaspora. And that's obviously a gigantic topic. So I was just curious, like, how you knew where you wanted to go with that. Or, I mean, it seems like you've kind of done different aspects of that through your journey through time. So just kind of curious, like, I guess, starting from the beginning, any study.
growing up in the United States, many of us had the unfortunate experience of the educational system having a very limited exploration of slavery, mm-hmm. where there are one or two actors that are thrown out, you know, your Harriet Tubmans, mm-hmm. maybe your Frederick Douglass, and then everyone else is just lumped in. And the general consensus is, you know, people were enslaved and then they weren't, they were freed, and there you go.
And these nice white people, let them go.
Right. Now, being Haitian American, I always was taught by our community, by family, that we were never given our freedom. We took our freedom. We're still being punished for that even today, but mm-hmm. that has always been and will continue to be a very collective cultural sense of pride that we rebelled, fought against the world's greatest army, Napoleon mm-hmm. and the French army, and won. Yeah. But the more I was talking to other people from other parts of the Caribbean in particular, and then meeting people who originally were from West Africa, it was quite just to hear the disconnect about slavery and how little was understood. And it didn't make sense to me. It made no mm-hmm. sense to me in the construction of our social memory about slavery. Why is it that we were only ever seen as passive victims with so few actors? Why is it only the horrific violence, racialized violence, subjugation, right. exploitation that is emphasized? Is there nothing else that could be said about the livelihoods, the experiences of enslaved Africans and their descendants? That just didn't make sense to me. So that's what I wanted to do through archaeology, was to see that, because, you know, Americans and the Brits and most of Western society gets to celebrate all these aspects of their rich history, but descendants of enslaved people generally aren't taught that in a predominantly white society.
Right.
Much less what contributions they had to that society as immigrants or whatnot. So what I definitely understood about archaeology before I delved into looking at plantation studies was that archaeology could do something that traditional historical studies could not, right? We know that, you know, we have that saying that victor, that it's the victor that writes records history, and that is what is remembered. And everyone else is forgotten, and their experiences is silent or forgotten. Mm-hmm. And we also know that it's a very skewed perspective. It's only what they are choosing to say, this is what's worth remembering.
Right.
Whether it's true or not. And we all know that, well, you can do that, but then, you know, if we write in our journal, for an example, and say, oh, I was so good with my diet this week, I did not indulge in any kind of, you know, sodas or sugary sweets. But we know archaeology cannot mm-hmm. lie. Mm-hmm. We will go and excavate and find the truth, whether it supports, complements, or completely contradicts what is left in the written record. And that's why I thought archaeology would be best for that, because the archive of slavery is violence. It is trauma. It is violence. It is something that was meant to silence or minimize any sort of Black resilience, dynamicism, anything of positivity that tried to covertly or overtly navigate around the institution of slavery and domination. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when you read much of these primary sources, it's hard. So there's the violence that was done to these enslaved people systematically, right? Mm-hmm. State-sanctioned violence in all these different ways. So there's that kind of violence. But then when you are a person who identifies as the descendant of these people, it is often very difficult to read in detail about that kind of violence. So there's a double violence. There's a double trauma that could occur. And so archaeology, or at least for me, I use archaeology to mitigate that, to be able to provide a fuller picture that therefore highlights for me, highlights, centers the experiences of enslaved people that does not rely on only talking about their subjugation, exploitation, and all, in many cases, death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's always, I feel like, a tricky one, because obviously, like, you want to, and I'm coming at this as a Jewish person, I don't want to get too far into that because that's not the focus, but like, you obviously you want to highlight the empowerment or the resistance or the love or the, you know, human aspects of the story for the people that are just being portrayed as victims. But also, like, obviously you want, you don't want it to, like, then paint too rosy of a picture. You know what I mean? Like,
no, right. I fully agree. Mm-hmm. That's why the work that I do, there has been and will always continue to be people who only want to, what I call, write about torture porn.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Right. There's always going to be people who want to write about torture porn. And that's, you know what? That's their swimming pool. That's what they want to do. That's not what I want. And what it is that I'm trying to do is to widen the understanding of what these enslaved people's lives were like. That, so I'm not contradicting that any of this horrible stuff happened, but I'm trying to say there was much more than that.
And more importantly,
the stories that I've been able, the histories that I've been able to uncover ends up being the kind that Black people are proud about, despite being under that institutional racialized terror.
Right. And that is, like, where, because obviously, like, Black people know the violence part, like, they know the trauma part. So that's the focus then, is like, okay, no need to re-traumatize because it's already there. But, like, adding another element of, like, to the story, I guess.
A more nuanced understanding that also brings a light to all that darkness. It's, and let us be clear, this has been on both sides, whether we're talking about Black people who do not really want to engage with the history of slavery, as well as white people who don't want to engage with slavery. For some, it's a question of being made to feel ashamed, even if they personally or their family had nothing to do with it. On the side of Black people, it's like, why do we need to bring this up again? It hurts. It's traumatizing.
Yeah, right.
Right. So I fully understand that. But when we're able to go deeper and consider different ways of looking at what happened and making a more nuanced understanding of that, therefore, I've been able to find these incredible new stories about Black joy and Black love in a time of slavery that has never really been talked about before.
Okay. Yeah. And I really want to get to those stories. One, I guess, thing I would want to say based on what you were saying right there is, like, I think obviously there's a difference from what you're saying from, like, what is happening here in the U.S. right now, or has been happening, where there's that attempt to, you know, quote unquote, take away trauma, like, mostly from white students. But really, it's not like what you're talking about, where you're talking about finding those, like, human pieces
that can be celebrated.
Right, right. The story of enslaved peoples, as opposed to, you know, what's happening here in a lot of places now is just trying to, like, make the whole thing seem less bad, essentially.
Not even less bad, just full blown lying.
Right. Yeah. You know,
completely lying. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, but anyway, I don't want to to recenter these people, those people that are trying to lie to the public.
That's not what we're here for.
Yeah, not what we're here for. So I am very interested in hearing about what you found, like, so these different projects that you ended up doing and these stories that you were mentioning.
So a lot of the work, or should I say a lot of the interest that people have found or want me to talk about is on slave cuisine and, you know, the culinary history of Black foodways, particularly those of the enslaved, and what I call culinary resistance. Food that when most people talk about slavery and food, it's always in couched in particular terms like the slave diet. And the slave diet, and it was, you know, the master's scraps from his table, all of these, which were completely false, because if you just think logically about it, do you really think that a planter or an enslaver with a family of, say, four or five has enough leftovers from his table to feed 200 enslaved people every day?
Yeah, no.
Come on. That's not how it worked. Not at all. But, first trying to understand, okay, what did happen? What was recorded in primary sources? What do we have on this? What were the colonial administrative rules on, if you have enslaved people, what is it that they should be eating? Do they have, slave gardens? Do they, what happens? So I started with that and then went to the archaeology to see, did it counter what was being said in all of these records? And alongside of these primary documents about, you know, what the colonial administrations were saying, there was a lot of European traveler accounts, you know, saying things like, these poor people, they just have nothing to eat. It's just, I don't know how they're doing all this work. Right. Again, just this dark view and they're passive. Mm-hmm. Archaeologically, I found something quite different. It's not to say that they didn't have to. There was an arena of conflict that was constantly going on, right? There was a battle between what the enslaver and the plantation management should have been doing, what the colonial administration said should have been happening, and then what the enslaved were doing for themselves. Mm-hmm. What I found quite interesting is that in all my years, and I am more than happy to hear if anyone finds documents on this, because I've never seen it. I've never found a document that says, if you're going to have beasts of burden, you know, your oxen, your donkeys, your mules, you need to feed them. Mm-hmm. I've never come across a document like that. And yet I've come across, not just in the British colonial context, but also in the French colonial context, if you're going to have enslaved people, you must feed them. How is that not common sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that there were repeated ordinances, right, first from the British government or the French government down to the colonial islands, and then within the colonial islands, again, reiterating, hey, hello, you need to be feeding them. And this is what you're going to feed them. And yet that wasn't followed all the time.
Okay.
So these enslavers were actually so, and it was, I found the word in one of the French documents that they said it was a stinginess that they were consciously choosing not to really try and feed these enslaved people. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people would have stopped with that story there, yet again, showing the passivity and the victimhood of these enslaved people.
Right.
What I found was quite different, that these enslaved people did not sit around to die of starvation, that they actively, consciously, aggressively created or adapted various subsistence strategies to not only make sure that they ate enough, but that there would be pleasure in the food that they ate. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't like to use the term slave diet, because our conscious our contemporary thoughts about the word diet is limiting, right? It has a negative connotation today.
Right.
It's very limiting. Right.
Yeah.
And Yet what I found was a discrepancy between what the external view, i.e. the enslaver's view of what the enslaved were making and eating versus what was going on within the slave communities. Radically different.
Right, which is like, again, one of those like where you get like archaeologists here in the US where they're like talking about counting calories, essentially. I can't think of the name of the theory. But anyway, but like people are people. They're not like, they're not, you know, these robots looking just to meet their minimum amount of calories.
But that's why I call, so when I use the term culinary resistance, yes, in part, they were resisting starving.
Yeah.
Right. Literally. So they took many different paths or considered a variety of subsistence practices, including having not just slave gardens, right, which were the areas right next to their slave dwelling for growing fruit trees, a lot of herbs, chili peppers, things like that, but also the provision grounds that were further afield from their slave village to grow the more substantial carbohydrates, the root tubers like yams and sweet potatoes and things like that. But along with that, they were supposed to be getting salted provisions, as in salted cod or herring, barreled beef, or what we call corned beef today. But that didn't happen all the time. And there were some reasons were because, well, in the Caribbean, the 18th century, the Caribbean, that was the Wild West. There was Europe was constantly at war. America was also at a certain point at war. And all of that always spilled into the Caribbean. And then, you know, with the pirates and privateer, you didn't know if a shipment of food was going to make its way and arrive to the island that it needed to.
Right.
But you also had the stinginess, as certain French documents put it, that the plantation management just didn't really try to make sure that their enslaved laborers were well fed and had enough food. So they themselves, the enslaved, if that meant taking a chance on sneaking off the plantation to go and hunt or harvest food elsewhere, gather food elsewhere, that's what they did. If that meant stealing, with the full understanding that if they are caught, they will be severely reprimanded.
Yeah.
But it was that important. And so there's the culinary resistance in that term, but I also use it in the sense of understanding, wait a minute, there is what the Europeans think as food versus what they saw the enslaved communities eating. A lot of these one pot meals, which they would call, they would say things like, yeah, they're eating these, you know, these stews. It's like a hodgepodge of a lot of starchy stuff and a little bit of salted meat, and it's really spicy, a lot of chilies. Oh, it's disgusting. Because in the mind of Europeans, that's not real food. Real food is beef, fresh beef, and the wide variety of vegetables and fruits that you can have. While for the enslaved, they didn't just make do, they made delicious.
Right. Right.
They were able to take maybe what to the Europeans' lens seemed to be meager ingredients, but they would change out one or two things all the time. And a soup, a brothy soup, can turn into a thicker one or into a chowder. One that's super spicy today is more mellow and herby the next. One that has shellfish this week will then prioritize the salted meat in the next. Right. So constantly changing because it pleased their palates.
And everyone else's too. Like, I mean, so at least here in the
interesting thing. And this is, you are absolutely right, Jessica. And that's why I use the term slave cuisine. And especially when I'm having these, so often when I'm giving these public lectures, I cook these dishes so that they can consume history, literally. So that they can eat it and understand this is what people were eating back then, which is very similar to what we call either Creole cuisine in various parts of the Caribbean or soul food in the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
So that they can have an understanding. And what's interesting is, you know, when I say, you know, I'm going to be talking about slave cuisine, there is always one or two white people that stop and go, I don't mean to be rude. That's impossible. Slaves could not have had cuisine. Once again, having this very external view of, then what does cuisine mean? Are you saying that cuisine is something that can only be done by white people?
Right, right.
They're not consciously trying to be racist, but it still ends up being racist.
Yeah.
Which they changed their minds by the time that lecture and that consumption activity is over.
Right, right. I mean, especially if you think about the fact that it wasn't even, I mean, a lot of the slavers, like, they were having enslaved people cook for them. And so, I mean, it's just this whole idea of, like, it not being real cuisine. Like, obviously, the enslavers, like, recognized that they were doing delicious things and wanted to eat it as well, which is how, like...
But they didn't write about it that way.
Right.
They didn't write about it that way, which, again, if you are going to base your understanding of the past solely on those kinds of documents, then, of course, that is the interpretation you get.
Right, right.
And so... So talking about this history in a different language and using cuisine consciously to demonstrate the culinary creativity, ingenuity that was performed by many of these, you know, there were men who participated, but for the most part, a lot of women that were doing this,
right,
who not only would showcase and make this food for their loved ones, for their family, but would sell it as street food. And then, like you say, also it be ingested, consumed by whites.
Mm-hmm.
Then how can you not call it cuisine?
Right. And it's shaped the cuisine of, you know, the U.S. heavily.
Very much so. Yeah. Very much so, right? That to the point where you do have a lot of Southerners who will never see Southern food as black food.
Right, right.
Now, if you really think about it, the vast majority of what you're eating, there is no case of black eyed peas. There's no Hoppin' Johns that came from Britain. It did not. It did not. Okay.
Yeah.
So helping them to have an experiential aspect to their learning by eating it really brings the message home. And then the other way I can help them understand it, particularly here in Scotland, is when I say to them, I said, you know how the rest of the world thinks of Scottish food. You know, they think that Scottish food is just deep fried Mars bars, haggis.
Haggis, you know, yeah, that's what I was going to say.
And that, right, things like that, the majority of the world goes, ick. And they all laugh because they know exactly what I'm talking about. And then I say to them, but you know what it is you actually eat. Mm-hmm. And do you care what the world thinks? And they go, no, we don't. And I said, I would say that is the same way the enslaved thought about their food. They did not care that the vast majority, right, of the colonial administration, European travelers, the enslavers themselves may have looked down on their food as not being cuisine. Mm-hmm. They didn't care because they know it was delicious. So much so that we still make and eat many of these dishes with some variation, of course, right? We have better access to more meat than enslaved people would have had in the past. But, you know, in the States, when you think about things like gumbo or in the Caribbean, kalaloo, very similar African based one pot dishes that all you need to do is substitute a couple of things. And it's always a creative way of putting your stamp on things. This person likes to put a lot of crawfish versus this person who likes to put a lot of crab. This person uses no shellfish. This person uses more chili. So there's always an individual element that personalizes it, as well as this collective understanding of this is who you are. And then I connect that to identity. Because if we all know the saying, if you are what you eat, then who makes what you eat directly influences who you are. And that were enslaved. That was enslaved women who were relegated to the very bottom of the colonial hierarchy of the plantation economy, right? When you look at all the records of slave schedules and the value of an enslaved laborer, Black women were always at the very bottom, even though they were the ones that were giving birth to more free labor for the enslaver. But still, they were never seen as skilled laborers and, you know, just general patriarchy. They just were not valued monetarily in the same way. But it is them. It was those women who made all this food that we still eat and enjoy today. So that has me centering women with a social power, enslaved women with a social power that is has not often been highlighted.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So I was so into that conversation that we went way over on that segment. So we're going to take a quick break and then we will be back for our last segment. Okay, so we're back. And before we move on from the last segment, I just wanted to throw in a quick plug for High on the Hog on Netflix. It's so good. And really, like, if you want to spend more time digging into this topic, it just goes really in depth on how enslaved people's food cuisine really like shaped American food. And it's really, it's just really good.
And based on High on the Hog, based on Jessica Harris's seminal work. So yes. Get the book.
That's yeah, get the book.
Get the book. Get Jessica's book.
Do both. Do all the things.
Yes.
Yes. I had to throw out that quick plug. But knowing that we could spend many, many more hours talking about this, we were talking about all the questions. Well, not all of them, but some of the questions that I would have really loved to have digged deeper into. So maybe we'll just have to have you on another time.
I'll be ready.
Yes. But for right now, I'd really love to talk about the work that you're doing right now. Anything that you're particularly excited about?
So I have started a new project in the Southern Caribbean, particularly on St. Vincent Island in the Grenadines, the large island, St. Vincent. And this is one of the weirdest, wildest projects. So I decided, okay, during lockdown, when we couldn't do much of anything, I stumbled across a number of documents from St. Vincent and just found I knew very little about that archipelago. When we think about the British colonial spaces in the Caribbean, it's Barbados and Jamaica for the most part. But I knew nothing about St. Vincent. And the more I was reading, the less I understood. I was like, wait, what? Huh? So I was like, let me get some money and go down there and see what I can find out and see if it's possible for me to locate a sugar plantation to do some research on. Mm-hmm. And so St. Vincent is the largest of its archipelago, and it's a volcanic island. It has a stratovolcanic environment, which is active, which actually did have a recent eruption 4 years ago. I arrived shortly after that. Anyway, I ended up finding a possible plantation that was quite far north, away from where most of the other estates or plantations have been relatively disturbed because of, you know, contemporary expansion of property and whatnot. So I found the Wallaboo estate that didn't seem to make any sense at all. It sits at the base of an active volcano. So get ready to expect to hear why it went defunct. I think you could probably already guess. It's named for the river that lies just south of it, which is, I didn't find out until later, the most unpredictable, violent river. Yeah. Ooh. So I did almost die once crossing.
Oh my God.
Yeah. All this crazy stuff. Anyway, this site is turning out to be the wildest, craziest place that I am looking forward to excavate. but I'm not going to break ground until I fully get the local community invested, because I want this to be a truly co-designed project with the local community as stakeholders, right? I want them to be part of the research design, the questions that get asked. And I'm okay with already seeing that there's going to be some discrepancies in what their social memory of that history is versus what I'm finding in the archives and what I'll find archaeologically. Mm-hmm. What is so strange about this site is that when it was French for a long time, with the French having a relatively peaceful existence alongside the indigenous people that were there. So the French came to establish some small plantations, and they brought a small enslaved African group with them. There was an indigenous community, the Kalinago. But then there's also what people at that time called the Black Caribs, which were what I would call the Black Indigenous, were people that were the Maroons and lived autonomously. They had a pretty decent relationship with the French. The French didn't mess with them, and they left the French to do their own thing. But in 1763, when those islands and Trinidad and others became acquired by the British, British had other plans. And the then Black Caribs, who we now use the term more so Garifuna, they did not get along. So much so that there were not one, but two wars that happened. At the end of the first war, there was a treaty, and so the northern part of the island was set to be where the Garifuna would reside, and then the Brits would have their plantations in the south. But the best land is closest to the volcano, so they just kept inching and inching, and that was causing trouble. But the estate that I'm looking at is smack dab in the middle of what was supposed to be territory for the Garifuna. So that was a big issue. And then I found documentation where Chateauier, the leader of the Garifuna, specifically said, "We never sold you that land. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to be there." And they never got a response for it. And I speculate that was one of the big impetus for the second and final war that happened. So much so that when it did kick off, they came upon the estate and the sugar plantation and fed one of the overseers through the grinding gears of the water mill. They sent a message. And so the location of the Wallaboo estate is strategic for being able to look out to see if there are going to be any ships coming, European ships that could come in and cause trouble, or look for their neighboring indigenous people from St. Lucia, nearby islands, for reinforcements, and just wreak havoc on the other villages further south. So all of that stuff is going on. The site also happened to just get damaged a number of times, not just because of the war, but after the war ended, because of environmental reasons. There were hurricanes and whatnot, but there were also volcanic eruptions.
Wow. Okay.
This place had bad luck.
Yeah, for real.
Bad luck. And even after slavery ended in 1834 or 38, depending on how you see it, it still functioned as a, you know, sugar plantation with, you know, laborers that were being paid barely. And 1902 happened. The biggest eruption. It decimated the entire place. That was it. Game over. Survivors didn't make it down south, that was it. It never came back again. And so...
Is it like a Pompeii situation?
Basically, I want to consider this the Caribbean's Pompeii.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's so much going on. And then being that I am living and working in Scotland, to find out that there's a significant Scottish influence, not just in terms of ownership, but the mechanics, the machinery, and the industrializing that happened after slavery ended is all related to Glasgow, like with actual stamps on the machinery that is still visible. So there's so many different ways for me to do this research. It's amazing. I'm so excited about it.
Wow. Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm very curious to hear, like, once you've gotten to work with the community and figure out how you want to approach it. That sounds really interesting. I have like a time capsule like that.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I'm not calling it an archaeological project. I'm calling it a heritage project because this is about them. This is their history. It's not mine. And it should belong to them. They should be part of how it gets interpreted. Even if that means my interpretation differs from theirs, I am fine that I am secure and comfortable in that tension if it happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Okay. Well, I guess we're at the end of our time, but if there's anything that you really want to mention that you haven't gotten to talk about your work-wise so far, like your online classes or any other resources, I just want to give you the space to do that real quick.
Oh, sure. I do so much of the work that I do is not just for students. I really believe that public engagement is important, right? That history should belong to all of us, not just those who are privileged enough to attend a university and take courses. So I have done a lot with what we call a MOOC, a massive open online course. There's one with FutureLearn, futurelearn.com, that is free for anyone to take on the history of slavery in the British Caribbean. I have talked about my work on culinary resistance and slave cuisine and other spaces that are available online. If you want to see exactly what it is that I excavated and how I came to interpret that material culture and the faunal remains into understanding what it is that the enslaved people were consuming and how that compared or differed from the historic records, all of that's available. You could just Google my name and find plenty of resources.
Awesome. All right. And we'll have some of those in the show notes, including the course on FutureLearn and an article from Sapiens on slave cuisine. So everybody enjoy looking at that. So thank you again. So it was such a joy to talk to you and hear all about this important work. Keep doing what you're doing. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we get to talk again sometime.
Thank you, Jessica. But the next time we do it, we should do it over food.
Oh my God. Yes. I've been so hungry this entire episode.
It's best over food. I prefer to do these engagements with food. It just makes things so much easier.
So the question is, am I going to Scotland or are you coming to the U.S.?
You can fly me to the U.S.
There you go. Oh, awesome. Well, hopefully, yeah, maybe at a conference sometime or somewhere we can grab some food. I'll let you know if I'm ever in Glasgow. And yeah, thanks. Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.